The conventional wisdom of transitional ministry was that change came to a congregation during that liminal time between long-term pastors. This liminal time in the congregation's life, a moment when the congregation was on the threshold of a new chapter, could be a flexible time. It was a permeable time. It was a time that the congregation would be flexible in a way that it was neither before nor after. And that was a moment of opportunity for the congregation. It was a time for the congregation to make adjustments necessary to prepare for the next long-term pastor, and then to resume the stability and the continuity when that new pastor was in place. Yet the reality of today's world is that it is one of constant change. It's one of rapid change. Virtually all of the time, there are no times of stability. It doesn't matter who the leader is. Flexibility and fluidity are the requirements for all congregations if they are to survive in today's context. Thus, the role of the transitional pastor, or in my case, the bridge pastor, has to change from the earlier paradigm. And one author believes that contemporary transitional pastors need to do three things. Transitional leaders need to articulate the new landscape that is before us, keeping the contrast between the then and the now in front of folks. Secondly, transitional pastors need to be adaptive leaders, not so much focusing on problem solving as much as about helping people change their perspective. And transitional pastors are to be harbingers of hope, not prophets of doom. They must move folks beyond a survivalist mentality to the possibilities that lie before them. Walter Brueggemann calls this type of work the important work of the sage in biblical tradition. In distinction from the prophets, the priests, the kings, and the rabbis with whom we're familiar, Brueggemann calls the sages the practical theologians of the Bible. Sages blend tradition and experience together, believing that God is in both. This is a combination of a three-way conversation among the situations in which we find ourselves, our best knowledge about the world and human nature, and thirdly, the inspiration from the traditions of faith of which we are a part. The sage is looking for meaning, for mystery, and for hope in the situations in which we find ourselves. Truth is not a static confession, but rather a process of utilizing the best information that we have at our disposal, along with our best understandings of who God is among us. There's also the recognition that we do not know everything about God, ourselves, or the world. For those of us who met yesterday afternoon to reflect on the evolution of assembly, one of the things that was mentioned was that assembly used to write position papers after much deliberation. How can we make a definitive statement about anything that remains fixed in a fluid and dynamic world? So many of those position statements we recognize are somewhere on a shelf rather than actively being used in the life of our congregation. We live with the experiences that we have. This recognition that we don't know everything about God, about ourselves, or about the world is what I have often called living according to provisional certitude. Now, you might think that's an oxymoron, but it makes a lot of sense, I think. We acknowledge with all humility that we do not know fully all that we need to know before we have to make some pretty important decisions about what to do and where to go. But as we step forward in all humility, we do that instead of being paralyzed because we don't have all the information that we feel like we need. We move forward rather than living in paralyzed indecision because we trust a God who is leading us step by step. Now, we acknowledge that sometimes God seems to lead us in a need-to-know approach rather than offering full disclosure at the outset, like we might wish from a divine guide. Nevertheless, we make our decisions and we live our lives without that full or complete information or understanding, but we do so in all humility, recognizing that sometimes we will be right and other times we may be wrong. But at all times, God is there to walk with us, leading us to a better place. Now, I'm not sure that I'm a sage, but that doesn't keep me from sharing my opinions. After all, the retreat committee invited me to do that, and so I'm simply doing what I've been asked to do. So here we'll go, and you can determine the sagacity of my opinions. As some of you know, in ancient Greek philosophy, especially that of Aristotle, the golden mean, or the golden middle way, was the desirable approach to life. This is the middle between two extremes, one of excess and one of deficiency. For example, in Aristotelian view, courage is a virtue. But if taken to excess, it can manifest itself as recklessness on the one hand, and in deficiency as cowardice. Now, Aristotle was not the only one who was infatuated with the golden mean. Buddha taught of the middle way, a path between the extremes of religious asceticism and worldly self-indulgence. In fact, there are those who believe that Ecclesiastes chapter 7, verses 16 and 17 is understood as promoting the middle way. Do not be too righteous, and do not act too wise. Why should you destroy yourself? Do not be too wicked, and do not be a fool. Why should you die before your time? Thomas Aquinas, the medieval Catholic philosopher and theologian, argued also that Christian morality is consistent with the golden mean. In fact, Islam promotes the golden mean in many instances. The Quran states an example in finance, in that a person should not spend all that he makes so as not to be caught needy, and the person is not to be stingy so as to be unable to live a comfortable life. The golden mean is one way of approaching life. It is a desire to not, as some people have described, fall off the road into the ditch that's on either side. So we stay the middle course. On the other hand, there is what is sometimes called the anomaly. It's a deviation from the common rule or the type or arrangement. It's one that is a bit more abnormal and doesn't fit in to the norm. It's odd or peculiar or strange. One might say that the anomaly falls on the margins of the bell curve. It's a standard deviation or more away from that middle where the masses usually align. As many of you know, I spent 20 years as a conference minister. At the conference level, life was very much focused on institutional life, very much engaged in attempting to find that golden mean. And for the first 15 years of that process, I believe we made great progress. We helped congregations and pastors thrive in order to do their best and to be their best in faithfulness. There was a sense in which we were all working together in diverse but common endeavors. And yet, it's my opinion that we do not currently live in times that value the golden mean. Extremes get far more airtime. Polarities are the common currency. Yet the primary function of institutions is to attend to the golden mean. And so in today's world, institutions are rather challenged at the moment. Now, my experience in congregational life, on the other hand, was more that of an anomaly. We were on the fringe of Mennonite life in more ways than one in Paoli in 1977 when I began congregational ministry. We were an emerging congregation in a geographic location that wasn't even on many of the Mennonite maps. In fact, it was very frustrating to me whenever we would send our notes about baptisms or marriages or births to the Gospel Herald at that time in Scottsdale, Pennsylvania, and we would indicate who it was and all of this, and that it happened in Paoli, Indiana. And the good people in Pennsylvania thought that there was only one Paoli, and that was Paoli, Pennsylvania. And so we were not on the Mennonite map for many years there. Many of the participants in that congregation were there because of a basic dissatisfaction with their previous church experience. They did not want to be part of a traditional congregation. And that worked out well because I had no desire to be a traditional pastor. Even 10 years later, when I moved to the more traditional congregation in Normal, Illinois, it was one of a handful of dual conference congregations that was seeking to speak into the two Mennonite traditions at that time, urging them to see a third way of working together. And my work as a transitional pastor at Albuquerque, New Mexico, was also on the fringe of both the conference and the denomination. I'll let you determine where assembly fits on the bell curve of Mennonite churches. Jesus seems, in many of the texts in the gospel, to suggest that the Christian life is more an anomaly when compared to the conventional wisdom of his day, and even Judaism. He talks about how faith is about servanthood rather than lordship. It's not about accumulating power and prestige, but it's about enhancing the life of others, even at the cost of personal suffering. He talks about taking up one's cross in order to follow him at a time when the cross was not something that was desired. So which is it, this life of faith? Is it the golden mean, or is it an anomaly with respect to conventional wisdom? In any dynamic system, and that's the reality of today's world, if we're concerned about the preservation of what's important, then institutions can serve us well. That's what they're designed to do. However, if it is not the preservation of what is important, but rather the determination of what is important that is our primary concern, then I believe that it's those who are situated on the margins that are better equipped to recognize what's important. That is to say that those on the margins, rather than at the center, are the place where we discover the real impact of our belief systems. Here is where the proverbial rubber hits the road. And just as there is flex in the rubber tires as they move across the varied surfaces, so are the adjustments that need to be made in our belief systems so that they are applicable to to the immediate situation that we're facing. That's where innovation occurs, at the margins, not at the center. Our principles need to be adaptable to the order in order to serve us rather than being inflexible, forcing us to serve them. Our faith enables us to explore the margins because we know it is God who holds the center together far better than we or any institution can do. We have to develop a mindset that enables us to deal with the dynamism in which we find ourselves. And on one hand, that means with the increasing size of assembly, we need to have some aspects of institutionalism in order to retain what is deemed to be important for all time. Yet assembly also knows that the larger institution known as the church, whether it be the conference or the denomination or Christianity in general, needs to sometimes be prodded or challenged to be clear about what is important in this particular moment of time. It's not an either or, but it's a both and reality. And I think assembly has done a good job of recognizing what are some contemporary important issues and beliefs in the present. You're able to be flexible and relevant to the biblical mandate in the culture in which you find yourselves. And you have many creative folks among you. Again, as was talked about yesterday afternoon, you made small groups an integral part of church life before they were trendy within the wider Christian movement. And now you seek a way to find the best way to institutionalize small groups into the life of the church, because you know that small groups are important as a way to know one another and to be Christian together. Structurally, we heard that assembly began as two and even three distinct meeting groups for a brief period of time. But then eventually, you consolidated into one group. And several acknowledged that that structural change was painful at the time. But they also noted that the ethos of the congregation of assembly is still the same, even though the structure is quite different from what you began. All of us must live with this tension of both anomaly and the golden mean. Now, you'll remember that when I mentioned the primary purpose of the sage at the outset, it was to provide meaning, to acknowledge mystery, and to offer hope. I believe that's what Paul is doing in his benedictory words to the Ephesians in chapter 3. He wanted them to be aware of the breadth, of the depth, the length, and the height of the reign of God, both in the world and in their own lives. They were likely merely scratching the surface of this vast expansiveness that was the reign of God. They had not yet arrived at their final destination, and he was urging them to continue the journey. I believe you're on the right track in your collective spiritual journey. You've learned valuable lessons from the past. You're ready to adapt some of your practices in order to deal with the realities of size and structure as you move forward. And you need to be open to new awarenesses and understandings as you seek to be faithful in a day that is in some ways similar to the past, and yet in other ways is completely new. And you must be able to live with the mysteries, those instances and circumstances that defy explanation, but are also a part of reality. As one person observed yesterday, while words have been and continue to be a very important dimension in assembly's life, it may be that assembly's rituals, those practices that go beyond words, are just as important in binding assemblyites together. It's a way of acknowledging the mystery that cannot be explained fully by no matter how many words we use. Now, given the size of the congregation, there will likely be more and different pastoral care opportunities than you've had in the past. And we also acknowledge that people in today's culture have less discretionary time to give to voluntary organizations than they did in earlier eras. This means that voluntary organizations like the church will need to find new avenues to accomplish tasks. What will a commitment to high levels of participation by church members look like in the future? The recent conversation on Third Hour about live streaming AMC's public services highlights some of the emerging challenges in this new day. How do we maintain the spirit of sharing that is understood to value vulnerability when there is also the desire to share worship services or other congregational meetings as a value of accessibility to those people who, for very good reasons, cannot be physically present at the appointed time? Vulnerability and accessibility are both important values, and they're not necessarily mutually exclusive, but neither are they identical. What will it look like to be able to embody both of these values in the life of the church? As a harbinger of hope rather than a prophet of doom, I want you to know that you have the gifts among you to figure out the path before you. As was noted again yesterday, in the early years, many people were attracted to assembly because it was a place to be remediated from the harmful Christian practices of their past. And yet there was the acknowledgement that now many young families come to assembly so that they and their children can hear the biblical stories in ways that can have a healthy and positive impact on their lives. The work of remediation has also fostered a new emphasis on the value of biblical stories in one's life. This is a process that you have embodied, perhaps unintentionally as much as intentionally. Well, hopefully, during this transitional time, we've identified some of the challenges that are before you, and we've offered some structural and leadership measures that will help you to plot a good and faithful course. The expansiveness about which Paul wrote to the Ephesians is a good word for you as well. There is more breadth to be explored. There is more depth to be plumbed. There is more length to be pursued. And there is more height to be climbed as you discover the vastness of God's reign and the many permutations that it involves. There is much good to maintain, while at the same time, there is much new to be explored. And God's Spirit will be with you all along the way. And knowing that is good news indeed.